Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. Joining me this time, Bloomberg columnist and author Zeke Folks, who has written a fantastic book, Number Go Up, all about the crypto universe. It's a book that started off with an investigation into Tether, a subject near and not necessarily so dear to my heart, as many of you will remember, and explores a lot of the more colourful aspects of the crypto community. And I just, having just read Going Infinite, Michael Lewis's book about Sam Bankman-Fried, I followed that up with Zeke's book, Number Go Up, and absolutely just tore through it. It was such an enjoyable read. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Zeke Fox. Zeke, thank you so much for joining me. I cannot tell you how delighted I am to have a chance to talk about this magnificent book with you.
Thank you, Grant. Great to be here.
Everybody listening to this podcast knows my view on crypto. I've been skeptical about it all along. And more than anything, it's just not for me. As my friend Tony Dean said, it's just not suitable for me. And so I've watched it with a jaundiced eye. But the one thing that I really did pay attention to and I wrote about and I did podcasts about was Tether. And that's, of course, how you started your journey. So let's begin with Tether, because everything to me begins and ends with Tether somehow. How did that come across your radar, and how did that journey go from covering that to then thinking there's a book in this?
I'm a longtime investigative reporter at Bloomberg, and my specialty is people who make a lot of money in interesting ways. When I say interesting, I actually mean ways that might land you in prison later. But I don't like to lead with that, because I'm hoping that my goal is to get these people to talk with me and to tell me about the interesting ways that they made money. So I really like people who operate in gray areas. And I've written a lot about new ways of loan sharking that are legal, penny stock schemes, and online marketing tricks. I love that world. Like, every shark on Shark Tank says, buy this weight loss pill. A whole world of people who've made fortunes on things like that. And so my friends would often tell me, crypto is great for you. You got to get into crypto and start writing about these crypto guys. But I resisted, because I really like a scheme that's a little bit complicated, where I can trace the money from one shell company to the next, or like read the legal contracts and figure out exactly why they think their form of loan sharking won't land them in trouble like gangsters used to get in trouble. And so these crypto guys, they're just saying, buy my coin. And then everyone buys the coin and it goes up. And also the way they said, buy my coin, they kept saying it again and again. It was getting annoying. I just didn't want to be part of that world. But then my editor at Business Week came by my desk and he said, what do you think about stablecoins? And the biggest stablecoin is Tether. At that time, Tether had more than $50 billion. If you're not familiar with it, what a stablecoin is it's a coin that's always worth a dollar because it's backed by real dollars in the bank. And the idea is that you send Tether, the company, say $1,000, and then you receive 1,000 Tether tokens, each of them worth a dollar, that are now on the blockchain, and you can zap these around the world, use them to gamble at different crypto exchanges. But there's a promise, which is that if one day you send your 1,000 Tether tokens back to Tether, the company, they will give you back your $1,000. And they've kept that $1,000 safe somewhere. And so when I started looking into it, there were 50 billion Tether tokens outstanding. And that meant that Tether was supposed to have 50 billion real dollars. And that's enough that would make them one of the top 50 banks in the US. But Tether, the company, was not saying where this $50 billion was. And in fact, a lot of people were speculating, maybe it doesn't exist. Could these tokens be backed by nothing? So I thought, this is a pretty good mystery. I could go try and look for these $50 billion and see what I can find. It doesn't involve any knowledge of blockchain. I don't need to write an explanation of how Bitcoin mining works. I'm just going to go look for these $50 billion and see what I turn up. My other objection to crypto was that some of it just seemed a little silly. Maybe that it wasn't important to the real world. But at the time when I started looking into Tether, just that summer, the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, had called a meeting of all the top financial regulators. And the topic of the meeting had been Tether. Do they have the money? What if they don't? Could this crash crypto markets? Could it spill over into regular financial markets? So the stakes were high. The mystery seemed solvable. And as soon as I dove in, I started meeting all sorts of really strange characters.
The cast of characters in the Tether story is, you know, from Devasini to Brock Pierce to Chalopin. I mean, there are so many fascinating characters. I mean, it seems like everybody is a character. Paolo Arduino, you know, all these guys are just almost like cartoon characters, right? Once you get into that world, you know, it's a stable coin, but where do you find a stable central character who's just normal that you can try and work around? So how did you go about taking all those disparate personalities and trying to be serious about it at first and think, this can't be how this whole thing works. These can't be the people in charge of $50 billion. How did you put that aside and say, okay, this is a serious investigation I need to do here?
It was clear people cared. There was a lot of interest. So one of the first stops on the investigation was, luckily, it was 2021 and the COVID restrictions were lifting and there was a big Bitcoin conference in Miami, Bitcoin 2021. Pretty much anyone who is anybody in crypto flew in for this. So I came in, I'm thinking I'll set up meetings with anyone who might know about Tether, anyone who's done business with Tether. And what this meant was I ended up meeting some of the biggest players in crypto because Tether is at the center of the crypto world. Pretty much anyone who's big into crypto does a lot of business with Tether. One of the first people I met was Alex Mashinsky, who ran a company called Celsius Network. And I, spoiler alert, he's since been arrested and charged with a massive fraud. But I did not know that would happen. So I'm sitting with him. He's actually like one of the biggest names and most legit people in crypto at the time. And when speaking with someone, I don't just come out and say, hey, what's with this Tether thing? Do you have any clues about whether it's a scam or not? I have to say like, all right, tell me about your company. So Mashinsky says, all right, I have this thing called Celsius Network. It's amazing. He always wore these t-shirts that said, unbank yourself. And his pitch was that banks were a scam. Celsius Network's awesome. And he said, just get crypto, deposit it at Celsius Network. We'll pay 5, 10, 15% interest depending on what coin you give us. And he said that if I wanted a loan from Celsius, he would charge as little as 0% interest. So I'm thinking, this plan sounds terrible. This is like a backwards business plan. My child wouldn't even suggest this, but I need to be polite because hopefully he's got some clues about Tether. And so I ask him, so like, how much money do you have under management at Celsius with this terrible plan? I don't say that part.
Right, that's the internal dialogue, yeah, right?
Yes, and he says $20 billion. I mark in my notebook, need to investigate this Celsius guy when you get back to New York. But then we start talking about Tether, and he says, oh yeah, Tether, they're great. They actually lent me 1 billion Tethers. I pay them 6% interest on this loan. And I'm thinking, first of all, amazing that you're telling me this new information that as far as I can tell, nobody knows. And then also, it was a Bitcoin-backed loan. And he says, don't worry, there's lots of collateral. It's totally safe. But I'm thinking, the original pitch for Tether was, we take your money, we stick it in the bank somewhere. Now I'm hearing about a billion Tether loan to something that sounds like itself is a Ponzi scheme. Like, this sounds very bad. And this was right at the beginning of my research. So I'm like, okay, you got to keep going. And at that same conference, I met with a young man who had flown in to celebrate the renaming of the Miami Heat NBA arena after his exchange, FTX. Another person I didn't know that much about, he wasn't that famous yet. We sit down, he's got this big mess of curly hair, he's wearing a FTX t-shirt, khaki shorts, tapping his legs like crazy. This is Sam Bankman-Fried. He's 29 years old, he's worth $20 billion. He's done all kinds of business with Tether. He's the biggest user of Tether out there. And he starts answering some questions about it. Because one of the questions was, is anyone actually sending Tether real money to get these Tether tokens? And Sam says, yes, like I send them real money. I wire it here, I wire it there. It's a little wonky, but I do send them billions of real dollars. Then he also tells me, yeah, like I may be one of the richest guys in the world, but it actually all just started when I was a teenager. I was thinking about becoming like an animal rights activist, but then this philosopher told me it'd be better if I just got rich and gave all the money away. And now here I am renaming the NBA arena. I got to get back to Hong Kong soon because the stuff I do at my crypto exchange would be illegal in the US. So like another entry in the notebook, this Sam Bankman-Fried guy, this might be worth a story too. So when I get back to New York, I told my editor, I was very wrong to resist crypto as a topic. It's a great topic. And once I'm done with this Tether story, I have four other people that we should look into. And what I realize now is that there was this whole crypto media ecosystem. There's all these crypto publications, podcasts, huge for crypto. And those people were looking at everything from like inside the crypto world perspective that wasn't really that understandable for someone in the outside world. And a lot of them are like cheerleaders for crypto too. The mainstream press, at least at that time, was still mostly dismissing crypto as kind of a curiosity. I was like, if we take this more seriously and look at who's making real money here, this could be a great topic for me. And so I published one Tether story in Business Week.
Which I remember was superb.
Oh, thanks. And I had a lot of fun doing it. The punchline with that was we found out that Tether had been investing in Chinese commercial paper, which also seemed kind of risky. And after that story, I decided, let's do a book about crypto and write about all of these characters and also try to see this mystery through to the end and figure out what's really going on with Tether.
So at what point did you, because you met with Giancarlo Devasini, right? And not many people have had that good fortune. So talk about how that meeting came about and what that meeting was like.
I will tell you about the meeting with Jean-Louis Vanderveld because it was a little more fun.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm curious about all these characters. So
yes. Okay. So Giancarlo is the CFO and Jean-Louis is the CEO. Both of them do not really come to crypto conferences, which is odd because conferences are one of the main things that crypto people do, just coming and giving speeches about how great their coin is. And they're so elusive that some of the skeptics thought that the CEO, Vanderveld, did not exist. They're like, I think he's just made up. And Giancarlo, I'm told by everyone, including Sam Bankman-Fried, I hear Giancarlo is the real boss. And he's Italian, was originally a plastic surgeon. And I hear he's got a temper. He doesn't like the press. And true to form, even when I publish this first story, I get no interview with Jean-Louis or Giancarlo. Giancarlo actually signs back up for Twitter. And I think an Italian complains about the fake news media that's going after him, but does not give me an interview. So I'm back in the Bahamas. This book required many trips to the Bahamas. I just want you to know as the reader that this poor author just had to go to the Bahamas like a million times to deliver this story for you. Yeah.
We feel your pain.
So I was in the Bahamas at a big conference sponsored by Sam Bankman-Fried to celebrate FTX. And you would think the Tether people would show up because they have houses in the Bahamas. This is their biggest customer. It's another one of those instances where all their customers are going to be there. It would be really natural to come and to give a presentation. But I don't see them there. But one person who I do see is Jean Chalopin, the head of Deltek Bank, who is a great character in the Tether story. He created Inspector Gadget. And he was not the money man who financed Inspector Gadget. No, he, I think, dropped out of high school to get into this cartoon business. And as a very young man, became really successful. He got rich from creating this beloved, hapless robot detective, Inspector Gadget. And with that Inspector Gadget fortune, he had bought a mansion in the Bahamas, eventually a stake in a bank in the Bahamas. Side note, also his own plane, which he piloted. To me, very nice guy. but essentially has the resume of a Bond villain. I mean, his mansion in the Bahamas, it was the villain's mansion in Casino Royale, the Bond movie. So at this point, we'd already met, and he had told me, this is one of the banks that Tether uses. And he had said, yes, I hold some of their money, but not the whole thing. I can't speak for the whole thing. And we enjoyed talking to each other. He knows a good story. He's a storyteller. I don't know. We just enjoyed each other's company. So we're in the Bahamas at this conference, and I'm saying, are these Tether people going to come? At first, he's saying he's not sure. But then at one point, he calls me, and he's like, the CEO, Jean-Louis, is here. Get to this spot in the hallway. So I run over, and Jean is standing with this tall Dutch guy who's got silver hair, and I recognize him from photos. This is the guy that people claim didn't exist. I'm like, oh, there he is. This is pretty exciting. And John introduces me, and he says, don't screw this up. If you screw this up, I'll kill you. And which I'm like, great. Wait, line.
Chalapin says that to you?
Yes.
Right.
With a smile. There will be no killing. It's just really great line. I couldn't believe he said it. And then I'm shaking Jean-Louis' hand, and I say, great to meet. And then he cuts me off and says, the man who doesn't exist. And I'm like, oh, great job, mysterious CEO. This is going to be great in the book. Because it's hard to turn off that, like,
of course,
commentary track in your head.
Right.
You know you're writing a book. So Jean-Louis proves he does exist. We sat down and spoke for hours in this casino in the Bahamas. We're hanging out. And I'm still wondering, at this point, I've been on the case for a long time. It's clear that Tether is really respected in the crypto world. The crypto people trust it, but Tether has not produced the evidence that critics are looking for, definitive proof that they have all the money they say, an accounting of where they're keeping it, evidence that they're not investing it in risky things. And in fact, I've seen evidence they are investing it in risky things. But John and I just talk for hours. I actually start to wonder, even though he's the CEO, it seems like maybe he's not that involved in the details. Either that, or he just doesn't want to engage in them and only wants to talk about the conspiracy of critics who are out to get Tether. And we left. I said, I would love to speak with Giancarlo, the boss. But he says, some people's emotions run hot or something like that. And that Giancarlo would not speak to me. And then I will not tell the whole story now, but I end up going to Switzerland twice to try to find Giancarlo. I thought I had a really smart plan. His girlfriend was having like a big art
show. An art show, yeah.
She's a Bitcoin artist.
Yeah.
Yes. And I'm thinking, okay, Giancarlo doesn't want reporters to find him, but what kind of weirdo reporter is going to go to his girlfriend's art show? He's going to feel like that's safe, but it's a pretty good bet he will go. I was really proud of myself for thinking of this. I flew to Switzerland to go to the art show, and I joined a junket of Italian art critics. They took us on a bus to the art show. I even got into the special preview day when VIPs would go. No sign of Giancarlo. He skips his girlfriend's art show. Disaster for the book. Then I returned in the same town. This town has become sort of Tether's home base, Lugano, Switzerland. Beautiful place if you ever get a chance to visit, right on Lake Lugano. Tether hosted a conference and Giancarlo did come, but my only memento from our it was nice to see him in person, but he kind of blew me off. And then he sent me a mean text message. When I was begging for the interview, he said, bees don't waste their time teaching
flies. Yeah.
That honey is better than excrement, which my kids liked that line when I told them about it when I got home.
So let me ask you, because you're the only person I know who's actually met Jean-Louis, and a lot of people have been trying to do that. And you spoke to him for a while. What was your impression of him? Obviously, you said he was most interested in talking about all the conspiracy theories against Tether, but what was your perception of him? Because, say, I don't know anyone else that's ever actually tracked him down. And actually, I do know one friend of mine who met him in the Bahamas and, you know, kind of played dumb about crypto and was spent a couple of hours talking to him, pretending he knew nothing about either who he was or what was going on. But what was your perception of him?
He didn't strike me as a serious player. He seemed just really caught up in how he had been portrayed in the media. He really wanted to talk about his resume. We actually had a very funny in hindsight, conversation about Sam Bankman-Fried, where at that point I'd spent a lot of time with Sam Bankman-Fried and he'd seemingly been very open with me. And I told this to Jean-Louis and he's like, well, it's so easy for Sam Bankman-Fried. He's got nothing to hide. We were there in the early days and there are just some things we can't really say now. But and my perception of him as not being central was confirmed when I went to Tether's conference. He was really off by his own. I did not really see him interacting with the other Tether people. Paolo, the CTO, was sort of the host of the conference, and he's now taken over as CEO. I'm not surprised because he seemed very eager to be the face of the company and to meet everyone. The one thing I did notice from the conference about Giancarlo, Jean-Louis, and Paolo, the main topic of the Tether conference was Bitcoin. And Bitcoin people, if you've never been to one of their conferences, I mean, they're really boring. People just talk for hours and hours about how great Bitcoin is and how it's going to save the world. And the problem is that Bitcoin is not saving the world. And so there's not like a lot of actual material to work with. It's just a bunch of people who love Bitcoin just saying again and again how great it is in these sort of content-free speeches. And the Tether guys were like in the front row all day long listening to this. I mean, I couldn't sit through it all. If you sat in the front row all day, you actually love Bitcoin. So these people, I think, are true believers in Bitcoin. And so the theories about Tether are like, was it unbacked? Did they take weird risks with the money? Where is this money? I mean, I think one possibility is that some of the money was invested in Bitcoin and that they did well on those bets. Seeing them just so obsessed with this really boring Bitcoin talk made me put more weight on that possibility.
This is the interesting thing to me because I've thought that as well. And the thing I just can't get my head around, and I got a sense even from reading the book that you couldn't either, but I'm curious to talk to you about it in person. This idea that if you've done well with Bitcoin and you've made a lot of money from your Bitcoin holdings, and maybe, let's say, at the beginning of Tether, the things that they couldn't talk about they did back then were the fact that it wasn't initially all backed and they did take some liberties and they did kind of do things they shouldn't do to get this thing up and running. But at some point, I just cannot get my head around why they don't just produce this audit, right? Because everything goes away at that point. All the doubt, everything goes away. And to continually fight that fight every single day when there's no need to is by far the biggest red flag to me because I just don't understand why they wouldn't do it. I know you struggle with that as well, but what's your thinking on that, having sat with all these characters?
So I'm with you. I think if they could do the audit, they would, because it would be just like a great way to show up all these critics who every day on Twitter are taunting Tether and saying, where's your audit? Where's your audit? Because Tether has been saying for years, we're going to give you this audit very soon. I mean, anything's possible. But let's say Tether has clean financials now. The fact that they're not producing the audit suggests to me that I think an audit involves like a several year look back. And I think that the lack of an audit suggests there's something they've done in recent years that just cannot pass muster. Or, I mean, there's always the possibility that there's something they're hiding right now as we speak. So I think that Tether has been saved by rising interest rates. Like when I started looking into Tether, rates were zero. And so this business model of sitting on a pile of $50 billion was actually not that great. It was sort of a problem. You had to figure out where to put the $50 billion and you would have to pay fees to people to hold it. Now they have $80 billion and they can invest that in US treasuries and earn $4 billion a year quite easily. And that's what they say they're doing. So they don't have to invest in Chinese commercial paper or loans to Celsius. And even if in theory, let's say they were short $1 billion before, well, they could earn that back very quickly. So I do keep coming back to what you're saying, where it's like, if everything's so rosy, where's this audit? But the other thing that I got interested in as I went deeper down this Tether rabbit hole, I started to feel like this question about the money and where it was difficult to solve, and that I was unlikely to get like the definitive answer I was looking for. But then I started to hear more and more about how Tether is used. And it pops up from time to time in unrelated criminal cases. And you'd see Russian money launderers arrested, and the FBI publishes his texts. And the texts say, "Hey, other money launderers, have you heard of this cool new thing called Tether? You don't have to give them your name or anything. You can move money so fast. It's awesome." Honestly, like once a month, there's a pretty good case. There was one recently with Chinese fentanyl traffickers who like to use Tether. And it's been in the news a lot because of Hamas using Tether, Russians moving money to Dubai, because they've created this great system where if you're not that familiar with crypto, Tether lives on different blockchains. So you can have your Tether on Tron or on Ethereum. So your Ethereum wallet, you have an address, which is like a 32-digit string of random numbers and characters. And that means that somewhere on this spreadsheet in the cloud, there's your address, and next to it is your number of tethers. And if you ever want to, you could use the blockchain to send those tethers back to the company Tether and exchange them for dollars. But if you don't do that, you basically just have like a numbered bank account, like one of these old Swiss bank accounts of yore, and the bank of Tether is like holding some cash on your behalf, and you can go move this money from your numbered account to some other person's numbered account, and no one's the wiser. And so I started looking into like, what is this semi-anonymous money transfer system enabling around the world? Because there's so many red flags around Tether that you would think, even if there's no like proof of anything bad happening right now, would you keep $1 billion at Tether? No, like you could keep it at a regular bank. Why would you do this? But if you want to move your money around the world instantly and keep it in an account that's not associated with your name, this is a great system.
Yeah. At this point in time, I figure the only reason this thing hasn't been shut down is because the authorities are getting so much information from it that they just want to leave this thing open. Because it you know, you look at what the things that have been shut down, and they've been involved in way less sketchy things than Tether has, right? So there's a reason this thing is not being closed for the time being, in my mind, anyway.
That's one of the theories I've heard from the start, is it's a honeypot, and they are somehow cooperating with authorities behind the scenes. I have no evidence for that yet.
No, I don't necessarily think they're cooperating. I think that the forensic analysts of the DOJ and the FBI and whoever are all over this thing and monitoring these flows, and it's probably a great source of information for them.
We will see. I think it's more likely that there just takes them a long time to build a case, and that there's like novel legal theories. And Tether, the company, like Giancarlo, Jean-Louis, Paulo, what they say is like, anyone who wants to trade their Tethers for dollars with the company directly, we need to know their name. We're going to check them out. And that we actually have only a small number of people that we will deal with. And therefore, we're on the up and up. But the thing is that Tether has become so popular that there's lots of ways to trade it for dollars without ever interacting with Tether, the company. And so one of the things I investigated in the book was, bizarrely, Tether's use by Chinese gangsters in Southeast Asia to run this terrible and enormous human trafficking scheme.
Yeah, the pig butcheries.
So these are guys who are like, they've lured workers into these office towers in Cambodia. They've said like, here, come here for a great job in customer service. Then when the workers come, they're trapped and they're beaten and tortured and forced to work around the clock, scamming people and sending like spam text messages and luring people into these crypto trading schemes. And I talked with, you know, human trafficking investigators who said that these gangsters use Tether even to buy and sell people between their operations. And they like it because of these, what I explained before about like the numbered accounts. This all could happen, and it could account for like billions of Tethers moving around. And the great thing as far as Giancarlo and Jean-Louis are concerned is they don't have to know these people. There's no evidence that they do. They've just created this system that works great for these criminals. And those criminals can figure out how to trade Tether for dollars on some crypto exchange that doesn't ask too many questions, or an over-the-counter desk, or whatever you want. And so that may insulate Tether's executives from legal liability for what these crooks are doing. However, there was this great case that predates crypto called Liberty Reserve, where this guy from Brooklyn just created essentially like a pirate version of PayPal that was really popular with crooks. And he had a similar setup where he would not trade his Liberty Reserves with just anybody. They're kind of like wholesalers. And in the end, that did not protect him. And he got arrested and charged with money laundering for setting up this system that was popular with criminals. So I think it's possible that Tether could have broken some of these rules too. I don't know. We will see.
Let's talk about the book itself, right? And the reception. And, your book came out at the same time, pretty much more or less as Michael Lewis's book, Going Infinite, you know? And I'm a massive fan of Michael Lewis. I've interviewed him once. He's an extraordinary guy, and he was super kind to me, and I loved talking to him, and I've enjoyed every single one of his books. And I was really looking forward to Going Infinite. And it came out, and I saw this deluge of criticism directed at Michael. And I was so disappointed. I was like, oh, man, I'm going to have to read this book anyway, because, you know, I can't just assume all these things. And I read it, and I have to say, to a great extent, I think a lot of the people who were critical of Michael were anti-Bitcoin guys who just wanted him to say, Sam Bankman-Fried is a crook and he should be in prison and come down. I thought the story Michael told was every bit as engaging as every other story he's told, and it was pretty clear to me what the conclusions from it were. So I read the book and I was like, okay. I don't think it's his best book, but I enjoyed the read, and I think a lot of the criticism is misplaced. And then I picked your book up afterwards, and I have to say, it was so enjoyable to me, because I think you did a brilliant job of taking all the absurdities, not just in the things we just talked about, but I want you to talk about the NFT stuff you found as well, because that, again, there's so much absurdity in crypto, and you have to kind of not take it too seriously when you write about it, in my view, because if you take it seriously, it becomes just weird. If you can look at it through a bit of a jaundiced eye and kind of with a half smirk on your face, it's so entertaining. And your book is that. It's so entertaining. So talk a little bit about the reception from the book, obviously the blowback, if any, of coming out at the same time as someone like Michael Lewis. How did that whole experience? Because it is your first book.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it so much. And it was intimidating to be up against Michael Lewis.
I bet.
Yeah. In this field, fun books about business, he's the acknowledged, you know, greatest of all time. And I had flown to the Bahamas on a different trip. I was sitting with Sam Bankman-Fried at his office, and he, being a weirdo, let me just look at all his 6 or 8 computer screens as he went about his day. And he had his Google Calendar up on one of the screens. It was right after the Super Bowl, where they'd showed the FTX commercial with Larry David. And I had it in my mind, I was like, all right, I bet Sam Bankman-Fried's going to go to the Super Bowl, because when you have an ad, you get to go. And wouldn't it be funny to see the crypto nerd at the Super Bowl with all the jocks? So I had been talking to his people about me going to the Super Bowl, with also, wouldn't it be cool for me to go to the Super Bowl? Never been. So I was like, I'd love to go with Sam Bankman-Fried and shadow him at the Super Bowl. I'm going to profile him for Bloomberg. This will be a great scene. And they had been a little shifty about it. And then I'm looking at his calendar, and I see like the couple days before were blocked off, and it said, go to Super Bowl with Michael Lewis. And I just thought, oh no. Because at this point, I'm already writing a book about crypto. Mine's not all about Sam Bankman-Fried, but it doesn't matter. It's gonna be about crypto. And now I see on this calendar, this is pretty strong evidence that Michael Lewis is also writing a book about crypto. So maybe wishful thinking, but I kept telling myself, well, maybe, I mean, he's so famous now, maybe he'll just skip right to the movie. Maybe he'll take his time. But in my head, I was very worried about this. And I'm thinking, like, every day, if I ever had trouble writing, I was like, listen, Michael Lewis is over there in California,
grinding away.
Yeah, you know, he's writing some mildly funny jokes about crypto right now. You need to try your best. Get your 1,000 words today. You know he will. He's famously a very fast writer. But I did not think that Michael Lewis was sitting there in California thinking about me. And I also was sort of like, if the books do come out at the same time, his will crush mine. It's okay. You still have to do your best. But what was amazing was that, and totally unexpected for me, was that they came out and that a lot of publications like Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Economist, Financial Times wrote joint reviews of them. And some of the reviewers said that they liked mine better, which was really awesome and surprising. I mean, I certainly have my complaints about going infinite, but I love reading about Sam Bankman-Fried. I think it's a fascinating story. So I probably enjoyed it more than the average reader. Now, Michael Lewis, he said one thing in a speech at a Bitcoin conference that I think sums up how we are different perspectives on this. And he was giving a speech at a conference last year, and he's talking to this audience of Bitcoin fans, and he says, "You all want to know what I think about crypto. You actually remind me of the evangelical Christians who I met when I was reporting The Blind Side. And I'm going to tell you what I told them. It doesn't matter if I believe in your thing. I'm writing Sam Bankman-Fried's story. And the only thing that matters is what he thinks about this." I don't think that's the right approach when you're writing about the greatest financial mania in the history of the world. Like, this is just like a crazy time. And at the center of it is whether you think there's anything to all of these cryptocurrencies. The central question is like, do you think this is just silliness, or is this the future of finance? And I don't think you can really duck that question and just say, I'm just writing from Sam Bankman-Fried's perspective. Let's say FTX isn't a fraud. I still think that he was promoting this like crypto casino where people are going to go lose their money betting on other scams. And I would still think poorly of him for that. So I think it's important to decide what you think about crypto. I think in the book, he also ducks the question.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I defend Michael to an extent in that I think his book was about one guy and he pulled in some of the outside stuff. I totally agree that he did duck that question. But I think the reason that I enjoyed your book more was that yours was about the ecosystem. And once you take that approach, there are so many threads you can pull on and so many things that must be just fall into your lap to write about. And you just go, oh, thank you, because there's so much in this. And one of those is your experience with NFTs. So perhaps you could just talk a little bit about that, because it's just a tremendous part of the book.
Thank you for bringing me back to this. It's probably my favorite part of the book and also the crypto story. And if you somehow missed out on this, we're talking about these digital cartoons that during the peak of the bubble sold for crazy amounts, like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars. And like so much in crypto, if someone gave you a pitch for it, it kind of makes sense. It's like, okay, you know, we all spend all our time on computers now. So art could be on computers too. And through the blockchain, we can establish ownership rights over digital images. And this could be like the future of art. And I don't know, like, it sounds plausible.
I never, ever got it. I'm sorry. That was the jump the shark moment to me. That was the bit I was like, come on, seriously.
The problem with it, like so much of crypto, is even if the idea sounds okay, what's actually happening with the idea is terrible. And it was, people were just churning out these collections of thousands of very ugly, derivative, similar looking cartoons. And then traders were flipping them like they were Dogecoin or any of these other to the moon kind of frenzies. Some of the crypto people I met would criticize me for not being a crypto trader myself. And they said that that meant that I was biased. And I explained in the writing world, it's quite common for the writer to not participate in the activity. Like, think about sports writers. Most of them don't play sports. Then I got tired of that. And I was like, you know what? Maybe I am missing out on the fun. I'm going to try it out. If I'm going to try it out, though, I want to go straight to the top. And at that time, the most blue chip NFT was called the Bored Ape Yacht Club. Justin Bieber had one, Snoop, Eminem, all sorts of athletes.
Jimmy Fallon, Steph Curry, right?
Jimmy Fallon, Paris Hilton. Steph Curry had done an ad for FTX in which he showed off a Bored Ape ice sculpture. And I was biking to work and I saw a big billboard that said "No Sleep Till Ape Fest." Look this up, and it's like a week-long party that's only for people who have Bored Apes. I'm like, you know what? If I am the reader of this book, do I want the author to go to this Ape Fest and tell me what it's really like inside? And I'm like, of course I do. You got to do it. And I want to know. And I found out that luckily, the Bored Apes at that time, the rare ones cost millions. The cheapest ones were maybe 500,000. I did not have that much from the book advance. But it turned out that you could go with these kind of Bored Ape derivatives. Because these Bored Ape guys, very impressed by their business plan. Once they got lucky with the Bored Apes, then they were just like, all right, let's sell these people some more stuff.
Right. The irritated apes. So they turned out like,
yeah, you want like bored dogs, pets for the apes. Now those are worth $10,000. Sadly, dogs are not invited to the party. But mutant apes gets you in. And these are apes that drank a potion and then sort of melted. So they look much worse than the regular bored apes, which were ugly to begin with. And you could get one for $40,000.
You know what? That right there is a time capsule. That you're saying that out loud and it actually happened is a time capsule right there. So carry on.
Yes. I sat down with my wife after dinner one night. Our kids are in bed. And I told her we had to talk about something important for the book.
You're a brave man.
Yes. Well, she's a very awesome wife who supported me going to Cambodia to investigate the human trafficking and also going to the Bahamas all the time by myself. So she's always supportive. But I explained this whole thing about the Bored Apes and the party. And maybe I was having a little fun with it because I asked her to guess like how much, now that I've described it, and she'd heard about Bored Apes, I think, how much do you think this is going to cost? And she's like, I don't know. We're having this conversation. It's got to be a lot. Maybe like $5,000. And I'm like, no, it's actually 40. And she's just like, oh, it's horrible. Her whole face just looks really sad about this. But we talked about it. And I explained that as silly as this all sounds, people were really trading these every day. And they'd been around for like a couple of years at this point. I only planned to hold the mutant ape for like a couple of days to go to the party. The odds were I could sell it afterwards. I mean, I was almost just as likely to make money as lose money. I'm not planning to lose all the money. But then, first of all, I didn't get around to actually buying it for a couple of weeks. I think partly because it just took so long to send all my money into the crypto world. There's like a lot of ID verifications and stuff. By the time I got around to it, the mutant apes prices had crashed and were now at $20,000. And that was cool because I didn't really want to send $40,000, but it was also bad because it showed that...
Yeah, there could be 10 when you come to sell it. Right, right.
Yes. And I found that the process of doing this, the crypto people had said, you'll learn a lot by becoming like one of us. And I did learn a lot. And what I learned was that even though this is a theme in the book, but my expectations for this process of buying the ape, I knew it would be bad, but it was so much worse than I had ever thought. I mean, just one highlight. First of all, I learned that the crypto wallet is just a browser extension. And it felt terrible to send my $20,000 into this browser extension, especially when the browser extension made me watch a video before I installed it that suggested that I should engrave the password on a metal plate and bury it in my backyard. And it was like, this was something I was really gonna do. And then like, I tried to get into this. So I did it. I did not engrave the password. I just wrote it on a piece of paper or something. And I got my mutant ape. I sent a picture to all my friends and I sent one to my mom. And then my mom just sent it back to me. And she was like, how is this yours? And like, this is my mutant ape. And funny like meta story here. I told this story on a YouTube video. And in the comments, some of the people were like, Zeke's lying. There's no way his mom could have figured out the secret flaw in NFTs. This didn't happen. And I actually went and checked with my mom. And I was like, Mom, did you hear something on NPR about this? Like, how did you know to save the NFT and send it back to me? And she's like, no, when you get a picture on your phone, there's a little button next to the picture to save the picture. So she identified the fatal flaw in this system on her own. So the people like mom are not impressed. They're just like, you're crazy and very dumb for buying this. Then I got to ApeFest, which was a big party in Manhattan. Snoop and Eminem and Jimmy Fallon were there, but nobody liked my ape there because everyone had an ape. They all basically looked the same. And so I would be like, look at my ape, look at my ape. And now I did not actually bring the ape in the NFT sense, which is another problem because I was really worried it'd get stolen. Everyone's talking about your NFTs will get stolen. So I only brought the screenshot. Nobody checked, but nobody cared. And in fact, even I met like teenagers who would say, wow, that's like a terrible ape. That might be the worst one that got you into this party. And I'm like, oh, I've seen through my plan. And they're like, check out my ape. My ape's got gold fur. It's worth $1 million. You're a loser. And so...
did you have ape envy at this point?
Oh, yes. I mean, I wanted to be one of the cool... there was a VIP for people who had better apes. I was just among the ape masses. But I did get to speak with Jimmy Fallon, who is a key promoter of Bored Apes, because he went on his show. He had Paris Hilton on the show, and they showed off their apes and acted like this was cool. And this was a thing that rich people were doing, buying these ape cartoons for $400,000. And I think that actually gave a lot of legitimacy.
Absolutely.
To these apes. And the rich people were making them their avatar on Twitter. Well, he did that. I believe Paris Hilton did too. And so, I mean, it was nice that Jimmy Fallon was right there. He's standing with his security guards, not actually mingling with the other apes. But I went around to the VIP and said, Jimmy Fallon, check out my ape. We're in the same club. And he was like, all right, cool. But then I said, hey, you showed off your ape on TV. Like, people bought these apes. At least some of them probably did it because of you. And now the prices are crashing. People have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he had no good answer. He just said, I did it for the community, which is the NFT people love to cite the community. And now ape prices have crashed. They're down 90%. But that raises a question. So if they're down 90%, that's still $50,000 for an ugly cartoon of an ape on the blockchain. Who's buying them now?
But finish the story. What happened to your ugly, horrible bored ape or mutant ape? What happened to it?
Oh, as soon as I acquired this ape, I knew in my head that I would be able to sell the ape. Like, there's an illiquid asset, but like five do trade every day. And so if you price yours at the bottom, it'll sell. But in my heart, I started to feel like I will be the last idiot who ever buys one of these apes. Like, this is it. No one's buying this from me.
Right.
And the website was actually worked so poorly that for a while I was convinced that it wasn't selling. But I did.
This is OpenSea.
Yes.
Yeah,
terrible okay. Website. I mean, it has this other problem where if you click your MetaMask browser extension, it does not show you that you bought the Bored Ape, which is like, I just paid $20,000. I want to see immediately that my ape is in my browser extension. You have to like restart twice and clear your cache if you want to see. That wasn't cool at all. Thanks for nothing, OpenSea. But someone did buy my ape, and this person who bought my ape, you can tag your Ethereum address like with your real identity, and they had done that. So I could see that it was a nice man named David Movsisian, and I found his Twitter, and he posted on Twitter, I sold it on the last day of ApeFest. And from his tweets, he said that he had bought the ape hoping to get into ApeFest, but he didn't realize that owning an ape doesn't actually get you into ApeFest. There's this whole separate ticketing system. And so I felt like pretty bad and like that I had tricked him. And that I'd scammed. I lost $2,000, but he paid me, you know, $18 for my mutant ape. But we set up a Zoom, and I spoke with the new owner of my mutant ape, and he explained that first of all, he was in the business. Like, you could hire him to crank out your own NFT collection. So this was kind of good advertising for him. And by the time we had the Zoom, the mutant ape was up about $5,000.
Okay.
So he said
everybody,
to me,
everybody's a winner. Okay.
Yeah. He's like, you did not scam me. I scammed you. I'm up $5,000.
That's terrific.
So yes, yeah, so there's a happy ending for all. I was happy to only lose $2,000.
Right. So Zeke, look, what's next now? Because I would imagine reading the book, I wanted more stories from this world, right? And so I've got to think there's another book in here in this world for you. Is it too soon for that yet?
That's so nice of you to say. I don't think I would do another crypto book, but we've had a lot of excitement since it came out. And
yes, we have.
I got to attend much of Sam Bankman-Fried's trial, where amazingly, Number Go Up was introduced as evidence. The prosecutor, she was cross-examining Bankman-Fried, and she was asking him, she's like, do you remember ever saying this or that? And he's like, I don't remember. And then she was like, Your Honor, I introduce Number Go Up, walked it over to him, and started having him read out loud from different pages to remind him of bad things that he had admitted to me. So that was amazing. And the trials of Alex Mashinsky, the Celsius founder, that's coming up in a few months. And I also think that like the Tether story isn't over. Where we end in the book is that Tether's making tons of money. The ex-plastic surgeon, Jean-Louis, they're both probably billionaires. And Tether is actually one of the most, if you believe their numbers, they're one of the most profitable companies in the world, more profitable than Nike. And I just don't see this being a sustainable situation. I don't have any inside information about what will happen, but I feel like there'll be a next chapter there. And maybe I'll get to revise the book and add another chapter.
Well, I do hope so.
I had so much fun writing the book. I always wanted to write one of these nonfiction adventure stories. Like I loved John Krakauer, Into Thin Air, or Ben Mezrich, Bringing Down the House, the MIT Blackjack Kids. And like I realized like, oh, this crypto is this story for me. You're on this crazy adventure. You need to write this down. I was also kind of sad to put down my pen because it would have been easy to do a Binance chapter. They're big users of Tether. Justin Sun, who runs the Tron blockchain, key character in the Tether story. So I was also sad to have to stop and not write any more chapters. So maybe for Bloomberg, I'll get to do some of these other ones.
Well, I hope so, because I say your writing is just so enjoyable to read. And again, look, I congratulate you on the book, Number Go Up. It's a terrific read. And everybody listening to this, if you haven't read it yet, I cannot recommend it highly enough. And Zeke, you know, whatever you write next, I'd love you to come back and talk to you about it because I've enjoyed everything you've written. But give people who aren't familiar with the work and have enjoyed this conversation, how can they give you socials and best place to kind of read you and all that kind of good stuff?
You can find me on Twitter at Zeke Fox, ZekeFaux. And Number Go Up's available wherever books are sold.
There you go.
Yes.
There you go. But get it soon because the supplies are going to run out. It's that good. Zeke. My friend, thank you so much. I've really, really enjoyed this. I appreciate you taking the time, and I can't wait to read whatever it is you decide to cover next.
Thank you, Grant.
Well, there you have it, folks. I know I harped on about it through the conversation, but the book really is a hugely enjoyable read, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. The book is Number Go Up by Zeke Fox, and my thanks to Zeke for joining me on the podcast this week. You can follow him on Twitter, at Zeke Fox. That's Zeke, Z-E-K-E, or Z-E-K-E, if you prefer. FAUX. And as I said, all his writing is excellent, but the book is particularly enjoyable. And I know that if you do pick up a copy, you will be riveted by it. That's it for me for another episode. I'll be back soon with another conversation. In the meantime, as always, thanks for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.